Hello, and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst, and this week we're taking a look at the future of the Conservative Party. As it heads for likely defeat at this year's general election, who will help shape the direction of the Tories as it navigates life in opposition? And will the world's most electorally successful party manage to keep its broad coalition together after being stretched to breaking point by factionalism in recent years? To discuss what the key issues will be, the dangers facing Rishi Sunak around the corner, and who might end up replacing him as leader, I have a fantastic panel with me. Firstly, we have Katie Balls, political editor of The Spectator, Henry Hill, acting editor of the website Conservative Home, Paul Scully, the Tory MP for Sutton and Cheam, and Gavin Rice, director of the think tank Onwards, Future of Conservatism Project. So I'm going to start with you, Katie, then. You know, if the Tories end up in opposition, I suppose it will come down to partly how many MPs they still have left, but who are kind of the key players going to be shaping the party's direction? We know a lot of talent, a lot of experiences is leaving. Who's still going to be around to kind of shape the future of the party, do you think?
Well, it ultimately depends which MRP poll you want to go on in terms of the scale of the wipeout as who has the safest seats. But I think if you at least entertain the idea that the polls could narrow, it could also go the other way. And therefore we're not going down to extinction levels of Tories left, then I think that we've already seen some of the key players who are trying to shape the debate. Some of them want to do a pre-mortem, not a post-mortem. But you have Liz Truss, for example. I don't think she is a future leader, but the launch of something like PopCon, popular conservatism, not the two words you currently put together for how people perceive the Conservative Party right now. But that is an effort not so much to do something pre-election as to get some like-minded figures together to start making the case for more free market conservatism, probably more an anti-net zero tone, and various things I think you would start to see pushed in the lead in a leadership contest, and something which is also about getting closer to the grassroots, which, of course, unless the leadership rules are somehow changed, and there would be a big row about that, yeah. Membership will have a big say on what happens next. And I think it's interesting there that Lee Anderson was with Liz Truss on stage when she launched PopCon. Obviously, he's now in the Reform Party, but you put that along with comments Liz Truss made about Nigel Farage when she was doing her American publicity push for her book.
And she was at his 60th birthday party last week as well.
Exactly. And I think you can start to see that there is a group, which I think I would put Liz Truss in, as well as potentially figures like Simon Clark, even though he's a little bit in political Siberia of his party at the moment. And Simon Clark will not, by all terms, really hold on to his seat. But, you know, there's those type of MPs who are pushing, I think, for the type of conservatism that would incorporate the Reform Party rather than try and distance itself from it. Then I think you will have figures like Kemi Badenoch on the right who, you know, if you think about her gang, it tends to be the crossing over between ideas and potential leadership campaigns here, but some of them are the same. And you know, the 2017 intake of MPs is quite loyal to her. I think with Kemi Badenoch, it's a mixture in the sense that often you read almost, I think, a caricature version of her, which is that she is this culture war warrior and, you know, that is all there is to her. Whereas I think the very fact that Michael Gove got behind her in the last leadership contest, well, the one before last, the one people got to actually have a say in the grassroots. And I think she's seen as to the right, but not so far to the right you couldn't carry the rest of the party with you. And I think the thinkers, or those who are trying to say, you know, we have thoughts on it, you have Robert Jenrick, obviously the former Home Office Minister. I think you have Neil O'Brien, ultimately, you know, this idea of alternative manifesto ideas. And then I think you do have the One Nation group who are trying to pitch themselves as we could be the queen or kingmaker. So start listening to us, but always written off for being too nice and should be in the Lib Dems.
Going to start throwing their weight around a bit more.
Exactly, but look at the seats, and actually there is a mix when it comes to safe seats of One Nation Tories, you know, traditional right-wing Tories and so forth, and some Sunakites, and therefore they think they could be a force to be reckoned with by the time you get there. I think the one caveat there is they could have influence on the ideas perhaps when it comes to the parliamentary rounds in a contest and where it goes, but the membership will probably move to the right given what's happened in recent years. So there's a limit there, but I think they'll be trying to say, let's not go all the way to Reform. We are the Conservative Party. We've been a long time. We don't need to mold into something else.
Yeah, so Henry, as Katie points out there, some of those people are going to be within the party, some of them are going to be out of the party, but are still going to have that kind of influence. People like Boris Johnson, even sort of Nigel Farage, are going to have that influence. Who do you think is going to kind of shape that direction, do you think, as going forward?
It's hard to say at this point, because there is going to have to be really an almighty intellectual reckoning from all parts of the party, really, on the past 14 years and how, no matter what wing of the party you're on, this really has been, I think, a fairly disappointing period of government. When you contrast it to what Labour activists could point to after 13 years in office, or what Conservative activists could point to after the Thatcher Major years, there really has been a failure to deliver on a coherent vision. And partly as a result of that, the Conservative Party now has an existential problem with its electoral coalition. It is polling in single digits with voters under sort of 25. You're really struggling to find much support for the party with anyone under about 45, 50. It's actually even now behind Labour amongst people with mortgages. I think that owner-occupiers who own outright are the only property class who now strongly back the Conservatives. And that coalition is going to shrink. And it's going to shrink over time. And the Conservatives don't yet have an answer for who is their voter base in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time. How do they rebuild those historic pipelines that used to turn people into Conservatives, acquiring property, settling down, starting a family, building up savings? And that is sort of beneath, but more important than the personality clash in a way. Because Labour are going to have an absolutely horrific time in office for various reasons that are probably slightly out with the scope of this podcast. And therefore, there might be a temptation simply to attack them really hard. And it might be, if the Conservatives don't get absolutely thrashed at this election, that the next election looks competitive, if not to win, then at least to really get back into contention. And that might tempt the party in turn to put off some of this. There might be a sense of one more heave, focus on criticising the opposition, and maybe we can do it. But really, you need to have, the whole party needs to come up with a change in diagnosis of what's wrong with the country on the scale of Thatcherism. I'm not saying they need to do Thatcherism again. Thatcherism was a response to the problems Britain had in 1975. But if you think about the scale of the change that represented for the Conservative Party compared to the old sort of post-war consensus Conservative Party, I think it needs something like that. And I think that the eventual winner might not be the immediate winner after the election, but the eventual faction that shapes the party for the next 10, 20 years is the one that manages to come up with a new answer to the question of what is the Conservative diagnosis of Britain in 2024, 2025, and what do we do about it?
Yeah, Gavin, that's obviously what you're looking at with your project, not looking at necessarily the policies for this manifesto, this election, but what happens beyond the election, you know, into that period, potentially in opposition, of what the party does for the next 10, 20 years. What do you kind of see as the kind of the key, not necessarily the personalities, but the key issues that are going to be the dividing lines and the policies that will shape the future of the party?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I also think what the policy priorities are kind of inseparable from the kind of cohort and demographic issues that Henry raises. Obviously, the party will respond to where it perceives its voter base to be. And I think it's reasonable to say that the Conservative Party has got a bit of an optimization dilemma at the moment, as an economist might call it, in that in order to appeal to its core base, it needs to pursue policies or continue to sort of allow policies to abide, which are not necessarily going to expand its future pipeline of voters. Henry was talking about appealing to people who are in younger cohorts, people who don't own property. I mean, actually, the most recent polling I've seen shows that the only age cohort in which the Conservative Party is ahead of Labour is the over 70s. And there's a clear margin for Labour, even amongst those between 50 and 60, which is a really shocking place for the party to be. I mean, I would suggest that the party was onto something in 2019 when it won an election with an 80-seat majority on a particular platform, which was a reform platform. And it was a platform in which the party was going to embrace a new direction and crucially appeal to a wider range of voters. And that's a wider range both in socioeconomic terms, so a wider range of economic classes, but also, importantly, a wider range of voters regionally, with an offer levelling up in particular, focused on parts of the country which the party had struggled to do with before. You know, this was not entirely new. It had attempted to kind of pursue that kind of electoral realignment in 2017, moving closer to both the economic values and the social values of the majority of the country. That was only really achieved in 2019, kind of riding on the crest of the wave of Brexit. And the really interesting phenomenon is that kind of consensus in the party feels as though it's been eroded away. And we've now got that kind of intellectual factionalism that you allude to. It seems that there's very little agreement at the moment in the party in terms of values and ideas about what the future should look like, which is why you're seeing those movements that you're referring to, PopCon, the so-called popular conservatives, the new conservatives, what Timothy and I are doing with Michael Gove, Onward with our Future of Conservatism project, because I really feel as though this intellectual battle has not been won and that future has not yet been decided. I think if there is a heavy electoral defeat for the party, there will be quite a lot of chaos for a period, and then there will be a deep period of soul searching. I think there is a risk that the party will want to go off in, I think, either of one of two directions. One would be Liz Trussism has never properly been tried, a little bit like old Marxists say about communism. Liz was right, and she was just undone by the party and the deep state. I think that would be unwise. I think that is, polling is abundantly clear that that is not really where the voters are. And also just on the raw economic practicalities, her strategy of, you know, deficit funded tax cut didn't work and won't work again. The other potential, I would say, sort of risk tendency might be to say, well, we need to drift towards the centre ground. Well, famously, the Westminster centre ground is not necessarily the centre ground in the country at large. It tends to be economically slightly to the right, slightly more free market than the average voter, but socially slightly more liberal than the average voter. So I think there might be a tendency to say, well, we shouldn't be talking about things like immigration. We shouldn't be talking about things like the border. We shouldn't be talking about things like law and order, because those are kind of drift to the right issues. Actually, these are very important policy issues for the majority of voters.
I'm going to bring Paul in there. You're leaving the parliament at the next election. I just wondered, you talked about how factionalism is one of the reasons why you wanted to quit. What do you kind of see the future, and which way of those two directions that Gavin talked about, which way do you think that the party should go, and which way do you think that it might go once people like you leave and are gone after the next election?
Well, I think the risk that there is effectively a lurch to the right. And you've got to be in the same room as the rest of the country, because, you know, I always likened it to the very fact that, when I talked about people being either under the bell curve in the centre rather than being the bell ends of the process, it doesn't mean wishy-washy centre. It doesn't mean all things to all men. It just means being in the same room as the majority of people, so you're actually able to take them along with you on that journey wherever you believe those ideas are. So we've got to start the process by taking a breath, having someone, in my mind, that's sort of more of a grandee-style leader that comes next rather than ideologue, who, rather than just trying to pull us to one side or another, makes the party leadable again so that we can have these conversations and redefine conservatives in a broader sense. Who that person is, I don't know, but we need that sort of communicate. You know, David Cameron did it well when he rebuilt a broad coalition after a long period of not learning these lessons from 97, when we just weren't listened to. So for the next few years, if the result ends up the way we think it's going to end up, people are just going to stop listening to us. They've already in many areas stopped listening to us. So then I think we need to make sure that, when you mentioned Thatcherism earlier on, lots of people still talk about, oh yeah, if only Margaret Thatcher is here. Well, do you want 1983 Margaret Thatcher, or do you want 1990 Margaret Thatcher? She was here for a long time, and then she changed, she evolved. So we've got to make sure first we're speaking to young people, because the core vote that you were speaking about earlier is getting smaller and smaller and smaller by just dint of logic, frankly. And we're not building up those coalitions, and we're not saying anything to younger people rather than something about house building, about aspiration, about opportunities. And so I do think Liz Truss, there was one thing that Liz Truss was right on, and that is about growth and about Treasury ideology. We're going to have the good conservative minded thing that a strong economy underpins all the rest of the public services, then we do need to have a far more focused approach to growth. Maybe, you know, have a more focused department for growth rather than just a control on spending.
Yeah. Katie, you talked at the beginning about which MRP poll you look at, because actually the conversations we're having, I suppose, because as you say, the membership will always get a vote, but before it gets to the membership, whoever becomes the next leader will have to get through the rounds of voting by Tory MPs. And if the party ends up with, say, 250 MPs in a very good result, you know, they end up not too far away, then that's going to be very different to if they end up with less than 150 as they did in 1997. Just talk us through what that will mean, what sort of coalition will be left within the parliamentary party under those kind of scenarios, and how that might affect whether you get a One Nation candidate down to the final two or whether you're with two right-wing candidates down to the final two.
Yeah, well, of course, we're talking hypotheticals, so apologies. Of course, of course. It's not that helpful. I think when you get to a wipeout point of below 100 MPs, say, you know, that worst case MRP poll somehow comes true.
I think the worst case one had the three MPs, and it was three MPs left with the worst MRP poll. I think there was just.
Was that an MRP?
I'm not sure. It was just John Hayes, and I think two other people. I think was the rest of the only party left.
Yeah, I mean, bet money on John Hayes now. Yeah. But no, you look at the recent MRPs. Say you go below 100. I do think at that point, it's just really unpredictable because it's pretty spread out amongst different seats. And also, if you think, I was speaking to a former senior whip about this, and they're saying, as someone who has in the past been involved in whipping or trying to help candidates when it goes, you know, how it moves, it's suddenly becomes really difficult to predict because you only need a small block to move one way to suddenly have a huge impact because the cohort and therefore the margins are so much smaller, which might sound like a stating the obvious, but I think it is why if you get to that point, it suddenly becomes incredibly unpredictable who the next leader is going to be because you don't need to win over so many MPs and we don't know which MPs are left. So the running joke these days, as well as ever someone says, you know, as a cabinet minister having drinks with selected colleagues, we say, well, the selected colleagues are just like, you know, the 50 MPs who always win their seat.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, the only electorate you can really trust at the moment if you want to be leader. But I think if it is, say, you know, 250, if it is a more modest defeat, I think then the question is, which is why I think there's such a debate currently about what is in the manifesto and the electoral strategy, is this one where, according to all the polls at the moment, the red wall is effectively wiped out and that 2019 realignment disappears, is why you often hear those MPs in the 2019 intake saying, we want this. And almost, I mean, Danny Kruger aside, he acts like he's in the red wall, even though he is not.
He's in Wiltshire.
Yeah, but he does have a very safe seat. I mean, you know, he also stands for this group, which is, we think we need these things, otherwise we're not going to hold on to it. And they go more towards reform. So I think it's more if you suddenly have that 2019 realignment that started slightly in 2017, if you think about Ben Bradley and others, Lee Rowley, if that is wiped out and all those MPs, or the vast majority, do not hold on to their seats, I think it just does change the nature of the party.
Yeah.
Yes, you'll have some still arguing for that type of thing, but it will just be one of those ones where I think, to Gavin's point, which is almost about the 2019 manifesto pitch, I think you're going to see people say, actually, no, it should be low taxes, small state, and you'll have a bit more of an argument that way. And then, of course, so potentially the blue wall. So I think there's a bit of a red wall, blue wall, although I think you can have too much commentary on red wall thinks X as well as one group. It will impact things if suddenly that realignment goes. And then I also think in terms of, yes, the MP shakeup matters, but I think the thing that you can't underestimate, and Henry will know more in this than I do, but effectively the membership have had their pick. It was Liz Truss. Well, they had Boris Johnson. They didn't get a say in ousting Boris Johnson. That was MPs. They then picked Liz Truss. They didn't get a say in ousting Liz Truss. And then they got Rishi Sunak and didn't get a say. So I think that when it comes to the membership, they will be wanting to have their own candidate, and probably you're potentially going to have something where what the MP or the parliamentary party that remains wants is at odds with what the membership wants.
Yeah, Henry, I'll bring you on that. Yeah, a defeat will actually bring a kind of a demographic change of the parliamentary party. I think there's more, I think more female MPs have safer seats. Some of the parties from an ethnic minority background have safer seats. So you could see that kind of change in the makeup of the parliamentary party. And then, yeah, is that going to create perhaps more of a dissonance between the parliamentary party and the grassroots, who are ultimately going to get to choose the leader and therefore the direction of the party going forward?
And to an extent, that depends on the parliamentary party itself, because of course the membership only get to choose between the final two, and the MPs choose between them who those two candidates are. So the point of that, or the idea behind that system, is that ideally both of the candidates who are put to the membership are acceptable to the parliamentary party. Now, it's very hard in the Conservative Party to imagine a Jeremy Corbyn situation where you end up with somebody going to the membership on a tiny share who's completely unacceptable. But, you know, I suppose maybe we saw with Liz Truss what happens when you have a very divided parliamentary Conservative Party. But even then, I think she was brought down by her own mistakes rather than the parliamentary party refusing to accept her. So there might be some tension, but if you think about the way that the Tory leadership contests normally play out, you have a candidate typically from the right, and then you have a candidate from everywhere else, essentially. And I suppose it depends in part on who runs in which slot. I think going back to what Katie was saying earlier, Kemi Badenoch could run in either, depending on which candidates she boxed out in the early stages, and then probably win from either position, because I think that she's quite saleable. And it's important not to sort of overstate the unsubtlety, if you like, of Conservative activists' opinions. We survey them regularly, and they often surprise us when we've been reading what people have been reading about them in the paper. But yes, there might be some tension. But actually, I think really the danger is perhaps the opposite, right? When you're in opposition, you lose the moderating influence of being in government and having to deal with the reality of what passing policy actually entails. And it will be very easy compared to now to pander to grassroots sentiment, perceived or real, to pander to the right-wing press. And so, no, I don't think really there is a danger of there being a massive disconnect. I think, if anything, the danger is perhaps slightly the other way, that if the leadership isn't careful, the new leadership, it ends up falling victim to a sort of audience capture, especially if Labour is having a bad time in office, which I suspect it will. And it will therefore be week to week, politics might actually be quite easy. But that will be a disincentive to do the hard philosophical and policy work that I think most Gavin agrees the party needs to do if it wants to form an effective government in future.
Yeah, so Gavin, on that, you know, if you look at the kind of the recent history of elections, you obviously Labour were out of power for a generation, then the Tories out of power for a generation, now Labour have been out of power. You know, it looks as though, especially if there is a big defeat for the Conservatives, that it won't be kind of a one-term fix. You know, Paul talked about how what David Cameron did when he took over in 2005 and won power in 2010, but that came after 8 years of opposition before he even took over. You know, if there is going to be this decade, perhaps potentially, or two terms maybe, you know, is that it's quite dangerous to be sort of in the wilderness for that time without that kind of focus of being, having to be the governing party, as Henry mentions. You know, what is the kind of work that's going to go on to make sure that there is that kind of, you know, the party's obviously been very good for a long time at kind of keeping hold of power, but I suppose that starts to go, dissipates when you've been in power for a long time. What's the kind of work that's going to be done to make sure it doesn't end up out of power for a long time again?
Well, I think, as Henry says, that there's really serious policy work to be done. And I think what's vital there is recognising that the challenges facing Britain in what was now moving into the mid-21st century are not the same as those of 1979. A lot of the decisions made by the Thatcher government, which it's tempting to just look back to, were right ones, but they've been done now. So we no longer have a large social housing stock to be sold off in a right to buy scheme. We don't have a top rate of income tax of 83% anymore. We don't have vast, inefficient, nationalised industries in the way that we used to. So the challenges are different, and they will require radicalism, and they will require thinking in the long term, and they will involve embracing trade-offs. And the most obvious one is housing policy. The UK's got a very, very restrictive, almost entirely discretionary planning regime. And the effect of this is that a generation of people are being blocked out of home ownership, and voters don't tend to switch to voting Conservative until they do a number of things. And buying a house is one of the most important things. The other is having a family. And at the moment, it's becoming very difficult for people to do those things. Onward's done a lot of polling that shows that actually younger voters, millennial voters, a lot of their instincts are quite small-c conservative. And we refer to them as shy capitalists. They want to get on the property ladder. They want to have a family. They want to do these kind of normal things, but they don't feel that the economic offer for them is there. So I think being bold about that is going to be important. I also think the party will, you know, it may need to have a kind of David Cameron moment where it thinks, well, we need to move to a position that is electable, that will speak to a broader range of voters than those that have continued to vote for us in this election if it is a loss in 2024. The risk is that you revert to base, but then, you know, what you actually need to do is the opposite. You need to be expanding to capture people that you've lost. And I think that does mean more open-mindedness about the economic offer and the way that that is broadened. But we've got to be talking about the issues of today and not those of the 1970s.
Yeah. Paul, just on that, obviously you're a London MP, housing, I guess, has been a big issue. Do you see that as being part of the problem, is that the kind of the strong NIMBY tendency within some of your party, and actually that for a new generation of Conservatives post-election, there's going to have to be a change there if they are to win back younger voters, if there is to be kind of a renewal on policy, that actually housing has to be kind of at the core of that, right?
Yeah, totally. No, absolutely. We've got to talk about that way, way more. I think there are things that we can do. First of all, in London, there is when the kind of numbers of houses we need to build. Some of the problem about getting out those mass numbers is that when we're just pushing it onto developers, and I'm all in favour of the free market, but the free market such that developers will only tend to push out 600 or so houses in one area every year, because otherwise it depresses their market price. Clearly, we need the houses built a lot quicker than that. So then how do you get that partnership working along with the neighbours who are worrying about suddenly 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 homes coming out in their particular area every year? You can do that partly through design. You've got to obviously have an infrastructure there, but you can partly do that around design. One of the most densely populated parts of London is Maida Vale. Not a lot of big skyscrapers in Maida Vale. It's all townhouses and those kind of things, beautifully designed homes. So if you can find a way of getting infrastructure, well-designed homes, a mixture of homes, then that, I think, helps depress the NIMBY approach. But so it's not just the policy thinking, it's the implementation thinking that's really key.
Yeah, but it's interesting, your party is a broad churches, and I heard you talk about the fact that, you know, the Tories are this kind of broad coalition, and that's partly why coalitions tend not to happen between parties, because the party is a coalition. Can they still be? You've been in that party for a long time. You've been in Parliament. You've seen different leaders, different factions taking charge. You know, there's talk about, if Sunak gets ousted, there might be a unity government. Is the idea of a unity government amongst the Conservatives, is that kind of for the birds? Is there an ability to keep stick together or not?
Well, this is what I was talking about, the grandee, because one of the problems you've had over the last few years, we were talking about earlier on about comparisons between the last Labour government and earlier Labour Conservative governments, etc., and what's happened since. We've had Brexit, then COVID, then Ukraine and Gaza. Each of these things have been massive, massive pressures. Rishi was always going to be popular when he was a Chancellor handing out £408 billion of money. When he's trying to get it back, that's always a little bit more challenging. So that was always going to be the case. And if you look at governments around Europe and the world, there's a party drift from right to left and left to right, but often it's the whoever's holding the COVID baby, the incumbency really, that is losing out. And we've been in that same boat. But on top of that, we've been saying things as a parliamentary party to our opposite numbers on the opposite end of the wing of the party that can't be unsaid. And so that's what I mean about having a grandee. You can dampen that down first, get everyone together, to get the grown-ups back in the room, and then say, let's have the conversations around the body of work that Gavin and others are trying to do around policy. It takes the shock of a defeat to actually say, crikey, what on earth were we doing there? We can't let that happen again.
Yeah, we'll kind of, before we finish, we'll wrap up, we'll talk about whether, you know, kind of the future, whether it actually is, which direction it will go, whether maybe it might get sort of usurped by reform or whatever. But just Henry, if I can bring you on kind of the short term, what is the danger necessarily for Sunak in the short term? There's lots of talk about whether there's going to be a push to replace him after the May local elections if they go really badly. What are Number 10 kind of doing to maybe to prevent that? But would anyone really want to take over the party before the general election, or would they want to trigger a vote of no confidence, knowing that he's probably Sunak's likely to win it, and then just sort of limp on into the election. What do you kind of think? We talked a lot about the long term. What are you kind of thinking about the short term?
So in the short term, we've actually, the Conholme survey, which was slightly delayed because of the bank, it ran on the bank holiday and then I was away, we actually asked our membership panel what they think about the prospect of changing leader before the election. And I don't want to spoil the results, but that will be out on Sunday. So tune in to Conservative Home for that. I think Rishi Sunak in some ways has the ultimate job security, which is that he has a job that nobody wants. Because all of the people who want to take over as leader want to take over afterwards, right? You know, they want to let Rishi Sunak own a defeat, which increasingly, despite the hospital pass he got from taking over from Liz Truss, many MPs do think he's earned, right? He's playing his cards incredibly badly. And then they get to shake the party in opposition. Whereas all that happens if you take over now is that unless you are an absolute miracle worker, you're simply the face on the Wikipedia page for the Conservative Party's worst general election defeat in about 50 years. So in that sense, I think he's probably fine. And you can tell that there aren't many candidates because if you read the press speculation about challengers, right, it's absurd. It's like Mad Libs, right? You've got the One Nation group talking about backing Priti Patel, or you've got the New Conservatives talking about backing Penny Morden. And it's like, those don't add up. It's just basically people who want to do something desperately looking for a candidate, and that candidate changes week to week. And then there's obviously the perennial, the true believers who want to call Boris Johnson back from where he sleeps under Avalon to come and save the Conservative Party. None of that is going to happen. No. There may well be a challenge if the local elections are horrifyingly bad. I think that was one reason that there was a case for the Conservative Party going in May. It would also have saved a load of councillors, but there's no candidate. And I think in the end, no matter how upset parts of the parliamentary party are, the fact that there's no candidate is going to be lethal to any prospect of getting rid of Rishi Sunak before the election.
Yeah, one of my lobby colleagues was joking. He thinks there might be two leadership contests before an election. You know, the sort of the such a taste for their own blood, the Tories will keep having leaders. But Paul, you're chuckling away there. You've served under a number of leaders. What do you think of the make of it? Do you want to see Sunak take the party into the election? Do you think that's kind of the best way, maybe to either to minimise a defeat or to prevent the kind of there being more of this kind of chaos and kind of roiling tensions within the party?
It's the only way. The only way, for the reasons that Henry said. I mean, I think we've been absolutely bonkers to start stripping away and said, let's go through this again. I talked about things that have been unsaid. You imagine us when we've got the situation that we're in at the moment. There are some green shoots in the economy. We are starting to turn that corner. But then I tell you what, let's just go back to 3 months of a leadership competition, talk to amongst ourselves again. You know, when people will rightly understand it in the country, say, can't we just all talk about it and have a general election? It just doesn't add up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Gavin, then last word to you then. We've talked about whether the party will, it's been extremely electorally successful, you know, but there's no guarantee necessarily that it will always be successful. There's talk of, you know, reform and chipping away, getting quite closer to them. There's talk of potentially a new party coming that splits away, you know, there's sort of reverse takeover, the kind of the Farage cuckoo situation, like what happened in Canada with their party of the centre right. What do you kind of make of it? Do you think that there's the strength within the party to continue with it or find a way necessarily to keep going? Or is it potentially that if we're doing this in sort of 5-10 years that it's no longer the sort of premium party on the centre right?
Well, I think the Conservative Party does have an astonishing ability to bounce back and to reinvent itself. And I think it is ultimately the party of patriotism and pragmatism. And I think that has served it well. It has historically been able to adapt to changing circumstances. It did that in, you know, the 1920s, 1930s. It did it in the 1980s. It did it with David Cameron. And it will need to do it again. An extinction moment is not impossible. You mentioned the Canadian Conservatives in 1993. That is the sort of the Damoclean sword that will be hanging over people's heads as the worst case scenario possibility. But the fact of the matter is, even if there is a very bad electoral outcome for the party, kind of the people aren't going anywhere. The thinkers and movers and shakers aren't going to magically disappear. And one of the sad things about the current situation is that there's actually a huge number of ideas on the centre-right, and there's more radicalism and boldness and imagination than I can remember in quite a long time, perhaps precisely because people are thinking that there may now be an opposition period and we're not just kind of firefighting in government, dealing with Brexit or dealing with the pandemic or whatever it is, right on the cusp of what we expect to be a defeat where those same talent, those same people will not be directly in power. So I suspect the party will survive. I hope it does. even if there is a kind of a cataclysmic moment for the structure of the Conservative Party, I don't think the people and the ideas are going anywhere. But there does need to be imagination and, as I said, open-mindedness about tackling the problems of tomorrow and not those of a previous generation.
Yeah, a quick final word from you then, Henry, on this kind of potential for an extinction-level event. What do you think is the most likely scenario then?
I think a Canada extinction event, I mean, I'm as guilty of anyone of writing about it. It's a very exciting comparison. But the Canadian Conservatives faced one very specific thing that you need in first past the post for that sort of event to happen, which is a geographically concentrated challenge. You know, we saw the SNP with their amazing breakthrough in 2015. First past the post normally holds out smaller parties, but if they've got a geographically concentrated base, they can break through. Now, in 93 in Canada, there was actually not one, but two of those. There was the Bloc Québécois in Quebec, which used to be a conservative heartland under Brian Mulroney, and there was the Reform Party in Western Canada. And that's what happened. And then neither of that is happening to the Conservatives here. Reform have no machine. They have no activist base. They've only managed to post, I think, two double-digit vote shares in actual elections, and both of those are in by-election conditions. So my suspicion is that the Conservatives will have a very bad election, probably worse than 97 in terms of seats. So my sort of pool number is 155. But they will be the party of the right. The Reform will probably not have any seats, and therefore the focus for rebuilding the British right will remain the Conservative Party, and that will be where the debate happens, and where, if ever, when the right gets back into government, it will be a Conservative government.
Can I say, Alan, that I think the key thing here for this change is social media and the speed of news cycles now. We've got to learn not to react to them, but to respond to things. Everything that Gavin said is absolutely right, but we've got to work through that implementation, through that communication, because even the Labour Party, who have been in opposition most of the time through Twitter and those kind of really immediate social media programs, they haven't got a platform. They are just going to be hoping they are not us. So there's going to be a sigh of relief rather than a great joy for Tony Blair coming in. So they haven't done that policy work. So we do need to do this, but we have to work out how we're going to land this, the ideas, and implement them, when you know that they're going to be unpicked straight away by 1,000 viewers looking at this, which is something we haven't faced before as a party. It can be done, but we've just got to work out how.
That's all we've got time for this week, but you can read all the latest on the big stories from Westminster at politicshome.com and keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day week newsletters by clicking on the link on our homepage. Thanks to my brilliant guests, Katie Balls, Henry Hill, Paul Scully and Gavin Rice. Thanks, you all, for listening. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a nice review. And if you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter at politicshome, or you can email us via news@politicshome.com. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst, and this has been The Rundown.